Welcome, everyone, to Bitcoin OpTech newsletter number 298, recap on Twitter Spaces. Today, we're going to be talking about a cluster mempool simulation and some data that came out of that. We're going to talk about changes to services and client software, including a Stratum V2-related update and a Teleport Transactions-related update, among some other things. There is the Bitcoin Core 27.0 release that recently made its way out. And also our regular releases and notable code changes updates. I'm Mike Schmidt. I'm a contributor at OpTech and executive director at Brink. Merch?
Hi, I'm Merch. I'm a full-time Bitcoiner at Chaincode Labs.
We have one news item this week titled, "What would have happened if Cluster Mempool had been deployed a year ago?" And this is motivated by a recent post from Suhas on the Delving Bitcoin forum. And Merch, it looks like he had a record of every transaction and block that his node happened to receive throughout the year of 2023. And he has a record of all that, and he was able to then replay that in its entirety against a different version of Bitcoin Core that had cluster mempool enabled. And then he drew a bunch of conclusions from that, which we noted in the newsletter and we can jump into, and then some quotes as well from the newsletter. But Merch, maybe is that the correct setup to this? And then maybe we can get into maybe what's the difference between cluster mempool and, I don't know, do we call it legacy mempool? And then maybe some of the conclusions.
Right. So my understanding is that he must have been running two nodes, one that was using the regular mempool and one that was running with cluster mempool. And he used his records to replay all of the transaction submissions and the block discovery events. And whenever a block was found, he would use his two node variants to build a block template right before applying the new block. So basically on the mempool before reading in the new block, he would build his own block template. And it's important that you build them for both variants rather than compared to the actual block, because your block, your node might have seen some transactions that weren't available to the block builder. Often the actual block was given out to a miner and only found some seconds after. So the mempool might include transactions that are not in the block. So anyway, he had then these two block templates, one from the regular Bitcoin Core and one from the cluster mempool Bitcoin Core. And he compared those for the fees collected in the blocks. And yeah, pretty much that's what he did. He did then apply the actual block that was found, though, so that has some that'll cause us to discuss some more stuff later. You still there?
Oh, sorry, I was talking on mute. So we noted three of his findings. The first one here, the cluster mempool node accepted 0.01% more transactions. Is that just a fluke, Merch, or is there a reason behind that number?
My understanding is that it's basically, it means that there's very, very little difference. That's good news. It means that if you run your node in cluster mempool, it will largely process exactly the same unconfirmed transactions. And yeah, a difference of 0.01% is insignificant. There is a slight difference. So what he noted is, for example, transactions that got accepted to cluster mempool because they were under the cluster limit, but that didn't get accepted into the old style mempool because they were above a descended or ancestor limit. And that's of course expected, that different limits will apply differently. He also had the reverse, of course, where something might have exceeded a cluster limit, but was in line with the ancestor and descendant limit. He overall sidestepped larger effects of that by resubmitting all the rejected transactions whenever a block was applied. So basically he simulates the behavior of most wallets that will continuously resubmit transactions that haven't gotten mined yet. To answer your question, that's a good news.
Merch, is primarily what's being measured there then what you mentioned, which is under the classic mempool algorithm, it's ancestor and descendant limit based, so that if something doesn't go into the mempool for that reason, it exceeded those limits. And then on the flip side, then with cluster mempool, there's no notion of ancestor descendant limits. We're talking about cluster size limits being hit. And so those are the two like sort of rails that are getting hit in these simulations.
Yeah, that's a big part of what he is trying to find out. How hard will these new cluster limits affect regular use on the network? So we have at times seen very strange humongous clusters in the mempool. And because of the ancestor and descendant limit, how it works, you can basically go down a few child connections and then go up another parent, and you can make very broad clusters that are connected through child-parent relationships, but that don't directly affect each other's descendant and ancestor limits. So I think the biggest cluster that I've seen was 1,400 transactions or so. And so with cluster mempool, we would be limiting the number of transactions that are allowed to be in a cluster, the cluster being the transactions, the transitive group, closed group of everything that is connected via child and parent relationships. So a very broad cluster that would be permitted with ancestor and descendant limits may not be acceptable for cluster limits, and vice versa. In a cluster limit, you could descend further than 25 transactions down, but that would, of course, fall afoul of the ancestor limit, right? So basically, he's trying to see, is there a ton of people using big clusters in a way that would be affected by the introduction of cluster mempool?
The second finding was related to RBF changes between these two simulations. Cluster mempool uses slightly different replacement rules, right? I think it's focused on the fee rate diagram. Would the fee rate diagram of the mempool improve or not is the criteria for replacement. And Bitcoin Core's current RBF-related rules are basically what's in BIP 125 sans some slight differences. So there's some different rules there that are also being evaluated in the simulation. Do you want to first, Merch, is that correct? And then second, what came of the simulation related to replacements?
Yeah, that's correct. So basically, in BIP 125, we have a few known constructions where essentially a replacement is allowed by the BIP 125 rules that doesn't really make the mempool better. So, for example, when you have a low fee rate parent and a high fee rate child, you do not need to supersede the package fee rate of that, but just if you replace the parent, you only have to exceed the absolute fee of the entire package and the fee rate of the parent, but the package might actually have a higher mining score, like the package would be mined at a higher fee rate than the parent fee rate, right? So it is, for example, possible with the current BIP 125 rules to replace things with stuff that does not make the mempool better. So that is one of the main motivations behind cluster mempool, is that it will be easier and cleaner to assess the incentive compatibility of replacements and actually only accept stuff that makes the mempool better. And the tool on basis of which we do that is, as you said already, the fee rate diagram, which essentially is you take a cluster, you find out what the optimal order would be for picking it into a block, and then you look at the chunks in which it would be picked into the block, and you can calculate the chunk fee rates of those chunks and draw those as a diagram. How much fee will you collect for how much block space? And that forms a concave diagram. And if you compare two clusters, one with the original transaction, one with the replacement, you should see that the replacement is at least as good as the fee rate diagram of the original, but should be better in some part of it, at least. and only then would we accept a replacement.
And then the last conclusion that we noted from the write-up was related to how does this affect miners? Is the construction of blocks or the architecture of the mempool significantly better or worse under either scenario? There are a bunch of interesting histograms and graphs in the write-up that show fee differences between the two simulations and differences in fees. And what did Suhas tentatively conclude there, March? Is Cluster Mempool a clear win or a clear loser for a miner?
Yeah, so here it gets a little more complicated. The thing is, because he simulates, he plays back the actual history of the last year. And the actual history, for example, contains Coinbase transactions that later get spent. So you actually do want to replay exactly the blocks as they existed back then. And otherwise you might halfway through start having missing inputs and stuff like that. So anyway, one of the things that Cluster Mempool can discover is when multiple children pay for a parent. So if you have a parent transaction with two transactions that spend two different outputs, and they both are trying to CPFP the parent, in the ancestor set-based mining, what we currently use, these two child pays for parent situations would be competing with each other. The two children each have an ancestor set fee score, and the one that has the higher fee rate will get picked into the block first with the parent, and then the second child, unencumbered from the parent, will have a vastly higher fee rate, right? And with Cluster Mempool, we would discover that these three transactions would form a chunk together, and we would calculate the chunk fee rate across all three transactions. And in result, the three transactions might get picked at a way higher fee rate than either of the two child pays for parent constellations. So what can happen here in this simulation is that while you're replaying the blocks, you keep collecting the best ancestor sets. But there might be a cluster that contains some children pays for parent situations, and they just don't make it into the block. So for multiple blocks in a row, your comparison where you build the cluster mempool-based block template would keep picking up these children pays for parent situations and score higher than the ancestor set-based, whereas the ancestor set-based block template keeps going down according to the best ancestor sets getting picked out of the mempool, and then, of course, new transactions arriving. So one of the concerns that Suhas has here is that the cluster mempool, since the actual blockchain being built is not based on the cluster mempool template, scores higher repeatedly, because favorable situations of cluster mempool are not removed by the block. So he can only conclude that in the direct comparison of each mempool situation to build the next block template, every 70% of the cluster mempool block templates scored better. And that is a good sign. That means that cluster mempool does not appear to be doing worse than the regular ancestor set-based building, block template, sorry. But it doesn't really permit the conclusion that cluster mempool actually is always better. We sort of just have proof that it doesn't do worse. But altogether, those things are quite happy because Well, on the one hand, we know now we can do better incentive compatibility assessments. On the other hand, we know that mining will do better. We solve a big issue that's been in existence for years, which is that the building of block templates is not the exact opposite of pruning. So in the ancestor set-based mempool, we might prune things that are significantly better, that contains subsets that would get picked into a near block, even though their descendant scores are terrible, and that's why we prune them. And in cluster mempool, this is symmetric. So what we drop and trim from the mempool is exactly the last stuff that we would ever mine. And that's another one of the main reasons why cluster mempool is exciting. Anyway, so the overall take that I have on this write-up is it is looking like cluster mempool is working great. It will do at least as well in mining. Block templates are built way faster because we already have the order of each cluster. So we only have to look at what part of each cluster from the front we pick into the block, which is way faster than updating the ancestor sets all the time doing block template building. And RBF and cluster limits seem to affect only a very, very small count of transactions. So I think overall, it looks like there's no big concern with moving forward with the cluster mempool project.
That makes a lot of sense, what you mentioned about the analysis over bias towards cluster mempool due to the fact that the simulation is done on data that was in an ancestor descendant world, such that the cluster mempool best options weren't chosen. So they just kept appearing block after block, potentially, maybe overemphasizing the value of cluster mempool. Merch, if I'm a miner, this sounds like something that I would be paying attention to. What is I don't think there's any published timelines of cluster mempool, but maybe you have an idea of like availability if it were to continue to progress positively as it has?
Yeah, so there's currently a proof of concept branch that Suhas is maintaining. Hopefully there's going to be, Suhas and Peter are working on making some more improvements on that branch and then make the branch available for first reviews. I anticipate that might happen in the next month or so. But timeline-wise, it's a very big project. Mempool is at the center of the node software. Like, it interacts with P2P, it interacts with block building, it interacts with the wallet because the wallet submits its own transactions to the mempool and so forth. So the draft PR that I've seen has roughly 70 commits. I anticipate that it might take a while until it is picked into the master branch in smaller chunks and reviewed and everything. It would be nice to have it in the next release, but who knows? Maybe one of the next three releases if we're honest with the speed that Bitcoin Core development can progress on.
Is there something that our audience, whether that's individuals, but also potentially industry businesses or participants, could be doing to help this along in a productive manner, do you think, Merch?
I mean, if you frequently build large clusters in your use, I would say then probably there's better ways to achieve the outputs that you want to create. But if you often do that, maybe look at cluster mempool and see how it would affect you. If you're heavily reliant on replacement of transactions and or have implemented that, maybe take a look at the fee rate diagram replacement because it works slightly differently. And I mean, at this stage, it's mostly for the curious and heavily involved because there's not even a PR open yet for review. But yeah, if you're involved at that level, maybe take a look at those two things. And if that affects negatively, especially something that you're working on, maybe chime in.
Next section from the newsletter is our monthly segment that highlights changes to different client software and service software in the industry using and adopting and releasing interesting Bitcoin tech. First one here is Phoenix for Server being announced. I've seen it on their site as Phoenix for Server, but also more colloquially as Phoenix D. So Phoenix Wallet, built by the Async people who do the Eclair node. They have a popular mobile Lightning wallet, and they've now announced a simplified version of that wallet that has a GUI on mobile, and it's a headless Lightning node they call Phoenix D, and it's focused on sending and receiving. So the folks behind the scenes there at Async will be managing your channels, your peers, and any sort of liquidity management. So this would be targeted at developers who want to have some sort of Lightning send receive functionality, but don't want to worry about all of the plumbing associated with having such a Lightning wallet. So pretty cool there. I didn't play with it, but that's something that seems pretty interesting to me. Merch, what do you think about Phoenix D?
I think that could be very interesting for someone trying to run some sort of Lightning-enabled business. And I wonder, so obviously, if you already run a server or so, you won't gain a lot because your Lightning node might already be able to do most of the things that Async is doing for you. But if you sort of just have a website that you want to integrate your Lightning payments into, I think this could be a very attractive way of taking a lot of the complication out of running your Lightning service. And yeah, if I were in the web shop business, I think I might start paying attention. I wonder whether it would integrate well with something like BTC Pay Server, but I haven't read anything about that yet.
Interesting idea. Next piece of software was Mercury Layer, adding Lightning swaps. We've talked a little bit with the Mercury folks previously, I believe the parent company's Commerce Block, in their state chain called Mercury Layer. And this latest announcement is about adding Lightning swap functionality to their state chain. So they use these HODL or hold invoices to enable sweeping a state chain coin for a Lightning payment. And the way that they have that set up, so the state chain coin is separate from Bitcoin, but it's supposed to be a one-way peg, so that this isn't necessarily alt chains per se. And there's also some swapping functionality if you dig into the article, which I did not unfortunately post in the write-up here. There's some interesting research on their repository outside of just Lightning swaps, some atomic swaps that are possible as well using similar technology. So I apologize for not including that, but that's something that you can Google yourself and find the markdown file in their repository. Anything there, Merch, for you?
No, sorry, I haven't really looked much into that.
Next piece of software is the Stratum V2 reference implementation version 1.0.0 being released. We've covered the Stratum reference implementation previously in its alpha version. This is now the official 1.0.0 release. Stratum V2, as a reminder, is a set of protocols and tools for miners and pools to communicate. I think probably most people, the feature that people are most excited about or familiar with is this idea that an individual miner can choose their own block template while also participating as part of a pool setup. Obviously, that is something we as Bitcoiners are super interested in from a decentralization perspective. And in fact, B10C had some analysis recently. I'm not sure if you saw that, Merch, on Twitter, showing that it appears potentially some pools that appear previously to be independent were potentially participating in a sort of pool of pool setup, and that maybe the mining and mining pool ecosystem is a bit more centralized than we had anticipated. Did you see that research that B10C put out, Merch?
Yeah, I've skimmed it. I saw that it looks like some of the maybe seven or so larger mining pools are actually all mining is very similar, if not the same template as Antpool. So there had been long some rumors about several of the bigger Chinese mining pools all being just sock puppets of Antpool, but this template overlap seems to be pretty indicative of that, there being more to that rumor.
Well, hopefully some of the miners participating in that setup have some urge to want to help decentralize some of that and want to participate in some block template building themselves, and they can check out the Stratum 1.0.0 reference implementation release. There's also a starting guide. So if you look for Stratum V2 reference implementation, getting started guide that can help miners integrate that technology as part of their mining setup. Next software update is related to teleport transactions. Back in newsletter 192, we covered the announcement of the teleport transaction software, and that it, at the time, I think it was a 0.1 release, and it was implementing or trying to implement the CoinSwap protocol. The CoinSwap protocol, as a reminder, lets users create a set of transactions that look like different and independent. Well, they are different transactions, but they look like independent payments, but they're actually just swapping coins with each other. So an interesting privacy tech, but it hasn't had much momentum, at least the teleport transactions project hasn't, in the last couple of years, partially due to the primary author becoming ill. But in the last few weeks, a software fork of that original teleport transactions was announced, which seems to have largely re-architected the CoinSwap setup and also finished the original and also implemented some additional supporting features. So there's a tweet thread about that that you can dig into and find the GitHub backing that. And it's exciting to see folks pick up that torch and continue with it. I haven't played with it. I haven't seen much feedback, but you love to see people putting their time towards that. Any thoughts, Merch?
Yeah. So I think that bringing up the teleport transaction proposal in the context of Taproot being available on the network is pretty interesting, because previously the atomic swap that is performed between the two transactions required you to explicitly show in the Bitcoin script what is happening. And with Taproot, due to the tweak, you don't even show that it's a 2-of-2 multisig. You could have a music input that is under the hood, crafted from two keys, but people wouldn't even see that it's not a single sig transaction. So it'll be cheaper, and it will be even more like every other transaction on the network. I'm actually catching myself. I might have... I don't think that you have to show it in the script, but it would be a 2-of-2 multisig in the old style. So yeah, now it would just look like single sig. So it's even cheaper and cooler.
There is a version 0.1.star from the README file, which is a future looking version, sort of a roadmap checklist. And one of the items in there is transitioning to Taproot outputs for the protocol, which would, like you said, enhance some privacy and obfuscate some of the contract information. So that's great. Next piece of software that we highlighted this week was to the Bitcoin Keeper mobile wallet. Bitcoin Keeper is a mobile wallet app that has multi-signature capabilities, hardware wallet support, Whirlpool CoinJoin support, and in their most recent release before this newsletter was published, they've added Taproot wallet support. So it's good to see more Taproot adoption. I know we highlighted a lot of that in years past, but I still want to give a little kudos to folks that are doing that. So good job, Bitcoin Keeper team.
Maybe here a comment. The Bitcoin Keeper wallet was previously known as Hexa Wallet, and so they're not coming out of the nowhere, which was my first impression when I saw that name. They've been around for a while, just rebranded.
Next item, titled BIP329 Label Management Software. Back in newsletter 273, we covered a Python library that was for working with BIP329 labels, wallet labels. So BIP329 is the wallet label BIP that specifies how you can attach a little bit of text to transactions or outputs. And that's meant to be a piece of private information for you to say, maybe you received this from XYZ person and don't do this with this UTXO. You can sort of put labels towards those pieces of information in your wallet. So back in 273, we highlighted a Python library that helped facilitate some of that. And On top of that library, the same authors had built a hosted service for label management called labelbase.space. And that team, as of this newsletter that we're highlighting, now has a version 2 of that service and software, which include the ability to self-host your own version of that wallet management software. Wallet labeling management software that includes features like importing and exporting the wallet labels in BIP329 format and a bunch of other goodies. So good to see someone taking the torch on the label management side of things and moving that along. Any thoughts there, Mitch?
Yeah. So one of the things that people sometimes don't consider when they make the backup of their wallet is having the keys is enough to recover all of the funds, but you do not actually not all wallet backups actually store these labels. And especially for people that take a manual approach to privacy and build many of their transactions themselves, or at least label all of the addresses they create extensively, that can be a real loss when they have to jump back to a backup and don't have these labels. So my understanding is that the label base actually, just to be clear, stores encrypted backups, and that would enable someone to have access to these even if they have to roll back to a prior state or lose the device or something like that. So this is pretty cool. Makes life easier.
Last piece of software we highlighted this month was key agent Sigbash launching. Sigbash is a signing service. So how it works is you can actually buy an XPub from this service and then use that in a multi-sig setup. And the service will sign only in certain conditions that you specified at the time that you purchased the XPub. So that could be based on hash rate, Bitcoin price, a certain address balance, or after a certain time is what they listed as conditions. And I believe all those are being pulled from the mempool.space API behind the scenes. And a couple interesting pieces of tech that I thought were worth highlighting related to that, because I think on the surface that maybe isn't so interesting for OpTech listeners, but there's a couple of things I thought were, and I wanted to hear what your thoughts were on this, Merch. It uses blind XPubs, which is a proposal for how to blind XPubs so that the possession of a certain seed phrase doesn't reveal anything about what it protects. So I thought that was cool. I haven't heard too much about that. Any thoughts on that piece before I move to the next one, Merch?
I don't have a deep understanding of the blinded pub keys. If that is true and can be proven to be so, that would be very cool. But maybe as a different description or summary of what's going on here, this is an oracle that will sign off on something after certain events or conditions are met. And that enables you, for example, to make a bet on the price or hash rate with a second party, and then have this independent oracle that doesn't even know what it's signing or doesn't even know what you wanted the public key for. But when you do sign something, it does see what you signed probably. Anyway, it's sort of like a way to automate a judgment in a bet or maybe even fancier protocols or contracts.
Yes. Oracle is probably a good word to convey what's going on at the heart of the service. And the other piece of tech that I thought was interesting, nothing sophisticated, but I thought it was a clever add-on. So because it is an oracle, we'll roll with that term, instead of having some sort of a slashing mechanism or bonds or something like that to ensure that this Sigbash signing service doesn't go rogue, they make use of something that previously was referred to as like a GPG contract, which what goes on there is when you purchase this XPub, there's a date that you purchased it, and the service will then sign a sort of receipt with their PGP key and provide that signed receipt as well as an open timestamps file for the GPG signed receipt, proving that that receipt was signed on that on or before that date that the XPub was issued. So a few different things going on there. We have XPubs, we have GPG keys, we have open timestamps to sort of ensure somewhat of a reputation system. Now, obviously, if the service doesn't sign, that doesn't mean you get your money back or anything, but you at least have proof that they said they were going to do something and they did not. Anything to add there, Mitch? All right. Releases and release candidates. First one, the big one, Bitcoin Core 27.0 is officially released. Mitch, I know we've gone through the testing guide, which touched on some of the items that we covered here in the newsletter this week with the full release. I will turn it over to you as our resident Bitcoin Core developer to outline what you think is most interesting about the release. We can drill in as deep or as shallow as you'd like.
All right. Well, I think the biggest elephant in the room is that the 27 release will enable V2 transport by default. So we've talked about this a number of times before, but V2 transport will encrypt all communication between two nodes. Note that it only encrypts it, but not authenticates it. So what this achieves is, if you previously had a passive listener on the way between yourself and the node, all of the traffic was unencrypted and they could, for example, see if you were the originator of a new transaction that they never saw before. They were probably already, if they were logging that, if they were keeping logs on the Bitcoin traffic that was going through their nodes, they would, for example, be able to tell that some specific IP address might have been the sender of a transaction. But when now the traffic is encrypted, it takes a little more work to identify that traffic is Bitcoin traffic, because it no longer necessarily identifies, well, you have to run Bitcoin software in order to recognize Bitcoin traffic now, which means that any listener along the way has to come from being passive to actually actively man in the middling any Bitcoin communication. So that in itself doesn't make it impossible to be surveilled, but it makes it a lot more expensive and difficult. It may also enable other protocols that use encrypted traffic to piggyback on the popularity of Bitcoin and hide their own encrypted traffic by looking like Bitcoin traffic. And the idea in the long run is that this may be overlaid with an authentication mechanism, where if you are trying to reach a specific node on the other side, for example, your mobile client is trying to reach the full node that you're running at home, so that you trust your own node for information about the blockchain or unconfirmed transactions, then you would be able to authenticate that you actually reached the other node, and the encryption plus authentication would make it impossible to man in the middle undetected. Anyway, that's like the biggest piece probably. There is some stuff that excites the developers. So for example, in the 27.0 release, we finally switched to C++ 20. You require now a C++ 20 capable compiler to build Bitcoin Core. That's pretty awesome, because it enables us to finally use C++ 20, standard libraries and things like that. What else? There's a few smaller things. One thing that might be interesting in the context of potentially approaching mempool congestion is that 27.0 comes with the coin grounder coin selection algorithm, and this algorithm will minimize the weight of the input set when you build a transaction if the fee rate is 30 sats per V-byte or higher, or if you set the consolidated fee rate lower at a lower fee rate. So if you are building a lot of transactions, and if the Runes protocol actually leads to a lot of block space demand in the next week, you might want to upgrade to this release and use Coin Grinder in order to at least build minimal transactions.
I was going to say, maybe Runes is going to force people to upgrade to 27.0 sooner than later because they're going to want the Coin Grinder.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. And yeah, I think those would be my biggest ones. Maybe for developers, it's worthy to note that LibBitcoin Consensus is getting deprecated, and this is the last version that will ship it. In V28, it'll be removed. It's been a maintenance burden, and it doesn't really get used much from what we see. On disk saving file for mempool is getting XORed now. So if you have any unconfirmed transactions that have a funky byte string that might get picked up by a malware scanner or something on an antivirus software on your computer, then it's now XORed and it won't. And that's maybe probably not a big deal, but maybe interesting for some people. Yeah. The truck transactions, previously known as V3 transactions, are now available on testnet. So we'll be able to test package relay with two transactions pretty soon. So yeah, that's cool.
We talked about this maybe a couple times. I think there was a PR review club on it, but we talked about network adjusted time. And that is now removed from the consensus code, replaced with unadjusted system time. We had some conversations about that. I think you could probably Google or comb the site for those discussions if you're interested in more there.
Yeah, the big problem just is if all of your peers are lying to you about their own time, you would have a funky time. And so now we're just relying on the time of your computer.
Next release. BTC Pay Server 1.13.1. Our last BTC Pay release highlight was for BTC Pay Server 1.11.1, and that was in August of last year. So we've batched the last several BTC Pay releases into a single update here. We talked about making the webhook system in BTC Pay a little bit more extendable and plug-inable, I believe is the title of the PR. Also adds support for BIP 129 secure multi-sig wallet setup that would let BTC Pay Server communicate with multiple wallets as part of coordinating a multi-sig setup. And we talked about BBQR encoded PSBTs previously, and that's now in BTC Pay. And there's also a bunch of other features and fixes that we did not note in this particular release, but you're free to scroll through the last several releases back to 1.11.1 to see the details there. Anything to add, Merch? Final release for this week is LDK 0.0.122, and we referenced the 0.0.121 as well. There's two separate releases. The .122 release included two fixes that were around serialization and deserialization, and also an optimization around excessive unneeded persistence of state with LDK's channel manager. So an optimization improvement and two fixes in 122. And we did not have a chance to cover 121, which was also released last week. And that release fixed a deadlock issue and also included a denial of service vulnerability fix that seems to have crept up since the .119 release, which was related to a scenario where during LDK's handshake process with a peer, if a gossip message is received in the middle of that handshake from another peer, or if the user calls a certain function broadcast node announcement during that time, it can actually cause a panic in Rust world, and that it could be manipulated as a DOS vulnerability. So that was 121 and 122 for LDK. We have one notable code change this week to LDK repository. I'll take the opportunity, if anybody has any questions about Bitcoin Core 27.0 or any of the pieces of software that we talked about and Merch's great overview of the cluster mempool simulation we did earlier, feel free to post a question or request speaker access. LDK 2704 This is actually, I know we say this section is notable code and documentation changes, but I don't really recall actually having a solid documentation change here until now. I'm sure we've had it, but this LDK 2704 is 660 lines of documentation and example code around LDK's important channel manager class. We noted, and I'll quote here, the channel manager is a Lightning Nodes channel state machine and payment management logic, which facilitates sending, forwarding, and receiving payments through Lightning channels. So that sounds important. That sounds like worthy of having 660 lines of documentation and example code for. So that's what this PR is. Merch, anything to add?
I agree.
Any announcements? Upgrade Bitcoin Core. I saw Nicholas Goga posted something, 20%+ of the Bitcoin network is on an unsupported version of Bitcoin Core. Obviously, there's features. Obviously, there's bug fixes. And you can get merch as Coin Grinder in the next 24 hours before things get crazy.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that a little bit, actually. So I've seen, again, a bunch of people talking about how they don't like some of the new features or are generally unhappy with what Bitcoin Core contributors have been focusing on, and therefore are running old versions. A popular one seems to be 22.0 for some reason. The release cycle of Bitcoin Core is such that the two major brand releases are maintained until a new release comes out, and then those two latest are maintained. So when 27.0 was released, 25.2 was also released, and that is the final, presumably final, release of the 25 branch. If there's something really dire that needs to be fixed, and it might get a security update, but features or smaller things will not be backported to the 25 branch anymore. 24 is end of life. It'll not get support. 23 is end of life. 22 is end of life. In the release 27, there's been, I looked it up yesterday, about 1,170 commits. And as you heard us talk, there's maybe a dozen or so notable new features in the release notes, or I should say notable changes. Not all of those are features even. So you might imagine that there is a number of other things that got addressed in the last 6 months, notably like 1,000 other code changes. We do fix issues, we do fix bugs. So if you're running a version that is multiple years end of life, there might be a bug in it that could cause issues to you. That's why people are harping on, you might want to run maintained software. Other things that happen are that, of course, operating systems get updated, some libraries might get removed. Eventually, software will just not install correctly out of the box, or the whole environment of what runs on computers changes over the years. So even when Bitcoin remains forward compatible in the sense that you can run old nodes and they'll be able to consume all of the blockchain data that is propagated and gossiped on the network, you do might want to consider keeping with the current version, especially if you run it as a wallet and have a service or money tied to it. Anyway, you do you. You can run old versions if that's your thing. Just be aware that we're not making this up. We're actually working on fixing stuff, and those fixes might be relevant to you.
Maybe one reason from the release notes of 27.0 that you might not want to upgrade is if you are a Windows user using external signing, that is disabled until the underlying library can be replaced with a different library. So maybe a reason there to hold back if you're in that Venn diagram, which I imagine is quite small. And then, yeah, so I don't know what's happening with I didn't see anything about this 22 being the new like thing that we jump back to. I know we covered a Stack Exchange question. I think it was 0.12.1 or something. People saying, what happens if I run it? What happens if the network runs it? I don't know. I think if you guys want to be hardcore, like, who was it? The Bitcoin Assets guys back in the IRC, Bitcoin Assets channel. They said, like, what was it? 0.3 dot something was the real Bitcoin. So why not just go all the way back there? Get back. What is this 22 stuff? He says sarcastically, please upgrade to 27.0. I see we have a speaker request, maybe.
If you do want to play it safe, maybe run 25.2. It's by far the... or 26.1, but if you don't want to upgrade to 27 yet. And that's reasonable. Give it a few weeks, especially if you have a service on it. But maybe don't run multiple year outdated software. Do you allow that?
Let's do it. Satoshi's Bride is connecting. Satoshi's Bride, do you have a question or comment for Merchari?
Yes, sir. Thank you for your time. My question is, if you're going to be a brand new miner, you want to do the new upgrade or you want to do something else? That's my question.
I think as a miner, you will not see a huge difference between 27 and 26. So if you want to play it safe, run 26.1. It's a maintained release that also was just released a few days ago. Some people choose to wait a little for a few weeks to sort of in case that the pre-release testing didn't catch something. If someone has an issue in production, they don't want to be on the latest version. That's totally reasonable. Just keep with it and keep an eye on it. Maybe just don't let it run for multiple years.
Okay. And then my second question is, I was confused between like SegWit and Taproot and which allow more transactions total per block.
So they are slightly different in the input size and output size. I assume that you're talking about pay to witness public key hash, which is native SegWit v0, which was introduced when SegWit came out, and pay to taproot, which is native SegWit v1. They are very similar in size. One big advantage of pay to taproot is that you can do multi-sig, where sign off of multiple keys is required, but it's still on chain, only looks like single sig. So, for example, if you are reliant on a multi-sig setup, that would be an obvious block space savings to switch to that. Regarding the actual transaction size, they're very similar. I have a write-up where I argue why, from the perspective of a user, it is economically rational to switch to pay to taproot. Was that your question?
But I guess I'm asking in regards to, I'm still kind of confused about everything, but basically, like, the limit of, I'm talking about Lightning and like the fees and lowering fees and how much messages you can send within one block.
Right. Okay. So SegWit introduced something called the witness discount, where it counts witness data at a different weight than other transaction data. So with the SegWit release the SegWit activation in August 2017, the blocks could get bigger, up to 4 megabytes. And this got more used over the years by more people using SegWit transactions. And most recently, of course, with inscriptions that write to witness data, we've seen some really, really big blocks.
Okay. But if I want to keep leap fees low, then I would go for the small blocks and the software with the small block ability.
It has nothing to do with that.
Okay, I want more transactions, though, per block, right? If I want to have leap fees.
Yes, but since we're a whole network that collaborates in producing blocks, it's not just up to you.
And Satoshi's Bride, if any of this is confusing for you, you could also always ask your husband, who could probably clarify some of it as well. Merch, anything else before we wrap up?
Nope, that's all from me.
All right. Thanks, Merch. No special guests this week. We did it. Just the co-host together. And thanks you all for joining us. And we will see you and hear you next week.
Hear you then.
Cheers.